And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Look at those 3D graphics.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2025. I'm now here with the Alternative Hypothesis, Ryan Falk. Ryan, I heard you complimenting the graphics there. Thank you.
Yes. And it's not AI generated. It's got that, it's got that turn of the millennium style. That doesn't look like a real world, but really insists that it's 3D graphics, right? That's the style I like. So you really know, it's like that PS1, PS2 kind of look. Excellent.
It was made with software called Dazz Bryce, which was last updated in 2012. But even then, it's hardly changed since 2000. So you're absolutely right. And I keep saying I'm going to learn something more up to date because it's so onerous to make these.
Oh no! It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Oh, I love it.
Thank you.
I love the graphics.
Thank you. I'm glad somebody appreciates them. It's nice to hear that. You are obviously a very familiar face in our circles, and I think most people will know of you. I think you've been going. Can you remember when you started on YouTube?
It depends. 2007 would be wow. I don't know. The thing is, I haven't had a continuous career or whatever. I'll go on YouTube and then I'll do stuff in life, and then I'll go on YouTube and then I'll do stuff in life. Often coinciding with bands or pseudo bands, the 2019-2020 purge. It was funny because at that time it was amazing. I actually caught the beginnings of them going through my account, and I was getting videos that were privated, flagged, and taken down and struck and stuff. So I just deleted everything all at once. Right, there was no time to do a fine tooth comb thing. So the account is still there, but I said, well, this is a good time to lay low because I've been on YouTube for so long that I see that supposedly there's a consistent terms of service that is applied all the time, but in reality they have sweeps. I don't know what they do. Is they hire a bunch of staff and get purges going or something, but
they were definitely doing something. I mean, there's no question.
It comes in there are purge waves that come in that come all at once. Right. And so I just sort of hunkered down to lay low, but then just kind of didn't want to come.
You felt you liked
being
away.
Really come back so much. Kind of like being away. Having a normal job. I'm not going to talk about what that is, right? Obviously, but it's just you show up, go to work, and I guess you could say maybe it's more work. I don't know, but it's you don't have to go, okay, what am I going to do this week? What novel thing am I going to try to make this week to do this thing and try to, I wouldn't say relaxing having a regular job, but it's you just do the thing.
It's regular. Yeah, I understand. I mean, I think that there are probably whole books that will be written in the future about what it was like to be a content creator around this era, the 2000s into the 2010s.
Right. Especially,
it's a specific thing.
Well, especially when you're making very heterodox content, we'll say, right?
Yeah.
it's not nearly as stable as if you're just making videos about like a topic, like if you're making like true crime videos or something. You can just make those forever. You don't have to worry about your account bleeding. You don't have to, right? It's, and so, but one thing that I guess is kind of tangentially related to that is I think one problem that I have, and I think this is a problem with you and with like every other, you know, heterodox content creator will say, is we don't like an inability to self-censor, right? Like, it's very hard. It's very difficult. Like you and I have like a logic train, and we want to follow that logic train, and we can't just like easily pluck things out of that, right? We can't just easily like say, oh, well, I'm just going to remove that and then modify what I'm saying a little bit just to, right. Like maybe things would be better if we could, but the reality is that like,
see, absolutely. I can't imagine keeping quiet about like the Rotherham, like the gang rapes by Pakistani and Brit. Like, I just can't imagine saying to myself, well, you can talk about most other things. You've just got to be quiet about that.
That right.
Just wouldn't make sense to me at all. I'd hate that.
Now, why don't you, now that seems kind of weird to me, because obviously I'm in the US, right? And so in the US, like, you can talk about, you know, the Islamic gang rapes and grooming stuff like all the time, right? I mean, it's just like common coin. It's just a thing that people can say. But is it like taboo in Britain to mention that?
Oh yeah. Yeah, but I meant specifically, yeah. I mean, you could, if you took it to, if you said something, if you phrased it in a certain way, yeah, you could get knocked at the door. What I meant was in reference to the social media companies, because if you
talk
stuff too much, then it's like your channel could just disappear. One,
yeah,
and you built up, you know.
yeah, I guess so. So what I was saying is that, incidentally, what I was thinking of is that there's actually a topic that I can actually dive into, and I can actually, you know, not have to censor myself on, I think, and that is on the topic of AI,
right?
And it's actually a lot more. It's either really really interesting and I'm onto something really cool, or I'm just nuts, right? I'm just insane,
right?
So
well, let's go for it. But first, I should sing your praises to some extent. I meant to do that at the very start, but I want to say that we are hearing right now from a guy who's had a great impact and who has a real talent. I want to say, you know, because what about you stepping away from YouTube and all the threat of censorship? You're one of the examples that I would raise of what a tragedy censorship actually is, because it prevents people from putting out content that has a real impact, that makes a real impact. And I think it's tragic.
Yeah. Part of it is my fault. Cause the thing is when you leave a thing for a while, it's like,
yeah, you know, do you really want to step back into
do you want to step back into it and have to start to build, you know, build the viewership back up? Cause, you know, well, like you pretend you don't, you know, and it's not like everything, but you know, you look at your videos, you look at the views and you look at all that stuff and it's like, okay, I've been away for a while. Let me come back. What are the views going to be? You know? So, you know, that's one thing, but it's also like, okay, I have to, there's also a flow to it and you have to like, you know, it's just, you know, it's just a little bit difficult to come back, especially when it's like, okay, so if I do this, if I do like another opus, you know, if I do like another Guns, Germs and Steel like thing, is it gonna get banned? Is it gonna stay up? Is it gonna, like, you know, or if I do another one of those things on like India, is that gonna get banned? Is it gonna stay up? You know, that's you know, it's hard to. Right, and this is something that people don't, like the effect of censorship you know, people who haven't actually been censored, people who haven't actually lived under it, they don't get it.
It's insidious. It's insidious. Right. The effect it has on you is so, it's subtle.
It's not just like, oh, you know, you're operating, everything's running ops normal, but then, you know, oh, a thing gets taken down and people can't see it. Right. That's obviously a big thing, but it's much more, insidious.
It's the chilling effect. You know, there are these very tangible things that happen like that. But long before you get banned, like long before your channel gets shut down, you're shitting yourself every day about that happening and you inadvertently doing something that makes that happen. So, I mean,
Everything I've been doing
was just awful for me because of it.
Is everything I've been doing for the past, you know, 2 years, 3 years, is this all just going to go poof because some Google Jeet is going to be like, well, this, you know, is going to look at a checklist and then say, oh, yeah, get rid of this. You know?
That was what was so disgusting about it, that some moron who might just have not much grasp of anything could just decide to shut down and destroy all of your work. Your life's work for a lot of us,
right?
And there's injustice of that,
right? And of course, you know, and I guess this is a little bit of a group therapy session here, but it's also like, you know, like Noam Chomsky, like kind of popularized. I mean, he didn't coin the term, but he popularized the term controlled opposition. Now he was looking at it in terms of like. We need even shittier shit libs, right? That's what he was thinking. He was thinking about it in terms of on like the Puritans, right? Like at every place and time in history, you know, there's sort of a hegemonic belief system. And I say hegemonic, not because because it's not necessarily what the majority of people believe, but it's like the sort of the plurality of power, right? And that's sort of what people call leftism. I don't like that term because it's a very what was that? I think the guy Bob Whitaker used this term, not Bob Whitaker, I don't know, but some guy mentioned the term temporal provincialism, right? It's very much because I see it as just like, you know, every place and time in history has a hegemonic belief system, and there's degrees of convergence to that, and there's degrees of deviation from it, right? And so today, what is deviation from the hegemonic belief system? That's what's called the right, and that's it. There's no and I'm sure you've seen that Twitter image where they show like, here's the cluster of left-wing beliefs, and it's just like a dot, and here's where we go to right-wing beliefs, and it's just like this massive sprawling web of like
different opinions.
Right, because the right is not a thing, right? It's not a thing. There's no, it's just degrees of deviation from the HBS, the hegemonic belief system, and the more you deviate from it, the further quote unquote right you are, and that's really what it is. And that's also why, like, and this also justifies a double standard, which is that when shitlibs are hypocritical. When two shitlibs say opposing things, right, which are clearly meant to justify something in different contexts, when they contradict each other, that's meaningful, right? That's meaningful and valid. But when two quote unquote right wingers say contradictory things, it's not, because there is no because it's not a tightly wound doctrine. In the same way. So it's just two different varieties
of nonsense.
Right. So the double standard is completely justified, right? Regarding calling something hypocrisy or calling something like, for example, like when the thing is like, I think what shitlibs do is it kind of project themselves onto like people they disagree with. And it's so bizarre. Like I hear people talk about the cult of Trump. I mean, that's just the weirdest, the weirdest thing. Like, look, there's, you know, like, I guess maybe Donald Trump is like the tastiest turd on the shit pile. I don't know, but like, it's just absolutely bizarre. And the funny thing is, like there was one thing I did in the past as sort of a guilty pleasure, but it's actually quite interesting, is looking at interviews of former Scientologists. You know what Scientology is?
Yes, I do. It's not really here in Britain, but I know of.
So look at interviews of former Scientologists, and one thing that's funny is that there hasn't been, and I did some work on this before, looking at people who buy quote unquote New Age materials, which, like, in the 1990s, particularly, there was a big rise in the U.S. of New Age religions, or pejoratively, you call them cults, right? Yeah. And some of them would have like mass suicide and stuff, but most of them did not. Most of them were just, in my opinion, they were just, you know, heresies, right? It was just a flourishing of heresy, right, from Christianity. There were mostly deviations from Christianity, so even the term cult to me as a pejorative just seems kind of inappropriate. These are just a million little heresies. But anyway, the kinds of people who bought New Age religion materials, urban, it leaned urban, it leaned female, it leaned, you know, professional class, it leaned, you know, it was basically shit libs, right? And that is, of course, in contradiction to a lot of perception that people have, because what they'll do is they'll go to, like, rural compounds where they find probably some of the worst ones. But, of course, if you're going to make a compound, you're going to make it in a rural place, like, even if the people are, like, you know, sort of professional class people, right?
You want them away from the
polluting influence of the non-believers, right? So basically, like, so anyway, so back to Scientology, basically all Scientologists, like, to a, like, in their ex-Scientology interview, to a man, as soon as they dropped Scientology, you know, it became, they all became like turbo shit libs. And in particular, there was this woman, Tori Magoo, who, like, and in retrospect, this is going to sound like even stupider, right? Like, when she left Scientology, George Bush was still president. And she was talking about how, like, oh, I see in George Bush, it's a cult. It's this religious right George Bush cult, which today just sounds like insanely ridiculous. Like, George Bush is one of the, like, least popular president, right? It's just wild. Like, so in terms of, like, the kinds of people who sort of congregate around, like, that sort of totalizing worldview, right? And one thing I pointed out was that when the New Age religion started to die off, right, sort of at the turn of the millennium, that's when, right, sort of the rise of what later became to be called woke, you know, half pejoratively, mm-hmm. half self-ascribed, tongue in cheek, right, whatever. But that's sort of when that started to, there was a bit of a lag, right? It didn't happen, right? It's not like, oh, the cults went away and then woke showed up, right? So there's obviously, there was a bit of a delay, but it was like a 10-year delay between, like, the right when cults started to collapse, well, and then woke started to rise in the U.S. So
definitely. That's a really interesting point, because you can see that it is that sort of person. It's the sort of person who's not logical or rational, but they are highly moralistic and conformist.
Yeah, I would be careful with saying not logical or rational, because most people who deviate from the hegemonic beliefs, like most people are, according to my, you know, fart sniffing opinion, are not, you know, sufficiently logical and rational in the main, right? And that includes people who converge on the sort of the hegemonic beliefs of their place and time, and those who deviate from it. So be careful about saying they're not logical. They're not rational. People are rational and logical when they want to be, right?
Yes, it's within a context.
It's like your amazing tweet, the tweet heard around the world of arguing with shit libs is basically
they're just constantly pretending not to understand.
Yeah, they're just constantly pretending to not understand. Right? Because white people, do white people exist? Right. So whenever when they want white people to exist, they have a very clear, right. They have no difficulty in seeing white people when they want to see white people. Right. When they want to point out, you might be a minority in Canada, for example, but you're not a visible minority. I'm like, well, what does that mean? Well, that means not white. Okay. Well, so there's a visibility, right? So it's just like, or when they want to say, oh, white people are inferior because they have Neanderthal DNA or something, right?
Yeah, they've got white privilege.
Right, but like when they want to say white people are inferior because of Neanderthal DNA, well, suddenly they can identify white people and identify the Neanderthal adage, right? So
genetically.
So suddenly they can genetically identify race, right? Or for example, you know, in those maps, I don't know if you've seen those maps of like IQ by state.
Yes.
Have you seen those? And it's like, okay, well, yeah. And people say, well, let's look at, percent black. People will just show the percent black, but there's also data on like by race and state. And it's like whites in Alabama are like the same as whites in Minnesota, right? Well, maybe not Minnesota, but like whites in, Indiana or anything. Right. So it's, so they can understand IQ, right? And even like my suspicion is that shitlibs are perfectly capable of understanding like IQ, right? If you were to say that like, oh, here's
if you were like, to say to them that conservatives have lower IQ.
Yeah, if you were to say that conservatives have lower IQ, have lower IQ, and then sort of explained, okay, and here's why IQ is valid, right? It's predictively valid, and you compare it to like other things, like, oh, look, a 30-minute IQ test is actually a better predictor of life expectancy, job performance evaluations, criminality, how much you're going to save. Literally anything that is like, colloquially associated with what we would call quote unquote intelligence, like IQ is like a massive predictor of that, and you could show them all that and say, and yes, it's like literally the best, it is like the diamond of social science. Like there is nothing that is, there may be specific things that are better predictor for specific outcomes. Like for example, family history might be a better predictor for alcoholism than IQ. Right. But there's nothing that just predicts everything, right, in the way that a 30 minute, just like pencil and paper IQ test can do. And they can understand that. They can understand that when they want to understand it. So when you say, oh, they're not logical, not rational, you need to be a little bit careful about that.
I mean, what I meant was not logical or rational by habit. They will happily believe something just because it brings them social credibility rather than because they've rationally arrived at that belief.
Right.
So that's what I meant by rational and logical. It's people who are primarily concerned with social acceptability and social status, and will believe whatever they need to believe to get that. I mean, I really believe that a lot of liberals today would be Nazis in another era if that's what it took to be fashionable, if that was the hegemonic belief system.
Oh, 100%. 100%. In fact, Himmler made a point of recruiting people from the KPD to the Nazi Party, and I actually made a video on that, showing that the commie Nazi pipeline was real, and it went both ways a little bit. KPD would join the NSDAP and back and forth for a little while, mm-hmm. until eventually the NSDAP just started to win and win and win. But it's a bit inferential because there's no like, there's no like direct data on that, but it can be inferred pretty heavily from, German state elections. Cause basically you can say like, okay, so in this state in Germany, you know, one election, it was 10%, KPD and 10%, Nazi. And then it went 5% KPD and 15% Nazi. Okay, and all the liberal conservative parties didn't move at all. It's like, okay, where did those KPD people go? And it's not proof. Like you could say, well, no, what happened was a bunch of KPD people joined like the liberal and conservative parties, and then a bunch of liberals and conservatives joined the Nazi Party, right? You could,
yeah,
but like, I mean. But one goes down, one goes up. Where's the flow going? Like, it seems pretty clear that's where the flow is going. Another thing that's interesting, and also pointed out that states, like basically within states within Germany at the time, the percentage communist was correlated with the percentage Nazi, right? So basically, states where you have more like what I guess we would call radical people, that tended to go together, and Sargon's going to come in and go horseshoe,
Well, that's what I was wondering about. How much truth do you see? Horseshoe, it's an annoying concept because there's some truth to it. Yeah.
There's a little bit, but it's really dumb the way there is a what might call a sort of phenomenal truth to it. But the way people use it as a way to shit on it is dumb. Basically, okay. So people who come to sort of like massive levels of rejection of the hegemonic belief system, right? What we call sort of far right or whatever. Those people tend to have low levels of social sensitivity, right? Which you could say is a polite way of saying like autistic, right? But basically, yeah. they're not as influenced by the opinions of others, which isn't to say zero, right? It's not like I don't care at all what other people think about me, like I do and you do, but a lot less, right? So, yeah. So there's that. So it's lower social sensitivity, and I'll also say But there's also another thing, which is systematizing, right? Heavily systematizing people. And the thing is, with the horseshoe, that is going to attract heavily systematizing people who want very coherent things. Because the thing about, like, what you call, like, the liberal conservative parties is that they're ad hoc. They're sort of a pastiche of positions that sort of emerge around, right? It's not like people thought things out, and you don't have like really intense narrow debates like amongst like conservatives or shitlib or like typical shitlibs about what is true. Like you're not going to have
profound fundamental.
How do I put this? Like, you're not going to have, for example, a disagreement about a nuance of IQ that could have cascading effects on evaluation of immigration or whatever. That's gonna cause like friction between members, right? You're not going to have like really. So you end up actually having a lot less friction, and a lot more, I guess, sort of tolerance of differences among sort of the muddled middle, simply because they're not as systematizing, right? It's, you know what it's kind of like?
Yes, they're not as autistic.
I used an example of biblical creationists and Sunday Christians, right? And so for biblical creationists, and this is, I haven't seen any studies on this, but this is just my personal experience. But like biblical creationists, these are people that are trying to make the Bible work, right? They're trying to make, okay, this book is true, right? You believe this book, right? So, okay, so if this book is true, then this and this and this and this, right? And so they're like reading it deeply, studying it deeply, like, and they're studying it to like make it work and make it true. And so, for example, from my point of view, when I was a Bab, right, because I'm this highly systematizing thinker, like I would read, you know, I would read the Bible, and then I would get to like Revelations, right? And so I was like, okay, so this book here, so all this stuff about the Gospels telling you how to live your life, and that's wonderful, and that's great, and that's true, and all that. But this book, Revelations, this is telling us about the future. So let's try to see the signs here, right? This is some guy who is apparently talking to angels and is trying to convert the angel speak into real world, and it was all metaphorical and all this stuff. But what we need to do is we need to try to see the signs, right? We need to see the signs. And people around me at the church I was at were thinking of me like crazy, right? Yeah. Of course, I was a kid, right? So they didn't really, you know. But in my point of view, that's actually less crazy than what they're doing. You know, to me, like the people who are obsessed with Revelations and the Rapture and young Earth creationists are actually more sane than the Sunday Christians, right? Because they're trying, because they're like, okay, this thing is true. Let's make it true. Let's make it work. But one thing about those people, about biblical creationists and sort of rapture focused people, is that they don't ever moderate those views. They either take those views to the grave, or they shatter and just become atheists. Right. There's no because the muddled middle doesn't give any kind of systemic anything. Right. Whereas just saying it's all just bullshit. Right. That is a coherent position that works. Right. Whereas the muddled middle is like, well, yeah, you know, the Bible says some things about, you know, how one should treat their slaves. But, you know, we don't really think about that. Or here's a passage that says something about, like, you know, how women should obey their husbands. But, you know, we don't really, you know, but whatever. We'll just, don't
take it too seriously.
Don't look too closely at that. Oh, this part, this is a, you know, Noah's Ark. Oh, that's a metaphor. That's, you know, or that's like a kind of a folk memory of a flood that happened that kind of got embellished. Right. But it's not really about what really happened. It's more about the spirit of the story, the lesson. It's like fables. It's like a book of Aesop's fables. And these books here, these are fables, but the Jesus story, that's real, right? You don't deny the Jesus story. You don't deny, you know, the whole Jesus arc.
But he walked on water and so forth.
Yeah, that's real and that's core. But those aren't fables. But the Old Testament stuff, oh, that's the Jewish Testament stuff, that's all fables. But anyway, so back to what you were saying about like the horseshoe. That's what people notice with the horseshoe, right? Is that people who have a need to make ideas work tend towards like the logical extension of those ideas, right? And so that is how and so, for example, it's difficult to parse out regarding, but New England was settled like by Puritans, like a lot of Puritans fleeing Old England because they were so unbelievably insufferable, right? And they've been insufferable to this day because those are the kinds of people who are like, you know, hardcore like abolitionists. Right, who really wanted to give like blacks, you know, citizenship. That was really important for them. Funnily enough, the white people who lived in the South, who had the most experience, were far less enthused by this idea. And then, of course, you go 100 years later, right? Like the heaviest support of like ending segregation, right? That all comes from You know, that came from white people who don't live around black people. Whereas the white people who lived around black people, they were big fans of segregation, right? Or like South Africa, sort of the same thing. Like everyone outside of South Africa, what you're doing is so terrible. You need to let, you know. So, but the whites in South Africa, they had a very different opinion about, you know.
Yeah, yeah, based on experience.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah. So the horseshoe theory, yeah, it's basically people who are systematizing are attracted to coherency. Total shit libs when they credit, like total like Marxoid communist people, whenever they criticize shit libs about being like inconsistent, you know, having incoherent, contradictory beliefs and all that. That's where they're correct, obviously, right? They're correct in the critique of the muddled middle, right? Which isn't very difficult to do. But it attracts those people. And that's why you can get transfer from quote unquote the far right to quote unquote the far left, right? At least in principle. Now, today in the censorious environment, that's a lot more difficult to do, right? And you have much more profound, you have much stronger hug boxes than you ever did in the past. You have, obviously, this isn't 1930s Germany. Right. But I'm just saying the 1930s Germany is evidence of sort of the psychological type. Right. That explains like the horseshoe that a lot of people are pointing to. And there is some truth to that. So
there is some truth to it. The problem is that there's not nearly as much. It's not the gotcha that they think it is.
No.
And they tend to leap on it with great glee, thinking, okay, so that's the end of the argument, that's the end of the debate. It's not. It's just one factor. It's of limited importance.
Right, but well, you could turn it around and say, okay, well, so there's horseshoe, but the horseshoe curves up, but then it also curves down, right? So like you could say, you know how they will say, they'll say
commies, it's like the Midwit meme.
Like commies and Nazis say, you know, they agree on this, that, or the other. But then you go down to the muddled middle. It's like, okay, well, the muddled middle agrees on this, that, or the other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Does that mean something bad? Does that mean something like it's just like I don't know. I think the idea is that these people who go to quote unquote the extremes, as they call it, right? Of course, what is extreme is entirely relative to like sort of the place and time that you're in, right? So this is like the idiocy of centrism. It's like, okay, but you're right. So even the very notion of centrism is like is temporally provincialist. Like, okay, centrist of what? Okay, so you're a centrist. So when someone says they're a centrist, like what I like to do is say, oh, okay, so you're a centrist, so you believe in the divine right of kings, you believe in, you know, the Pope as the avatar of God on earth. You believe in a legal stratification of those who work, those who pray, and those who fight, right? You believe in all those things. And it's like, that's a pretty centrist view for a 1300s Europe, you know? So you're not a centrist?
This is the thing. They always think when they declare themselves to be a centrist, it tends
it's
to
like
be
centrist of what? That's what you need to ask.
It tends to be with the assumption that to be a centrist is to be rational and right, and just sane, and not getting attracted to crazy far extreme positions. But that's not true because the center changes with time, as you say.
Right, right, and it's also like so. I'm the middleman, so I can, which means I can see both sides, and you can't. Right, you came to a conclusion, right? You came to a conclusion about a thing.
You actually believe in something.
Like you came to a conclusion about a thing. Yeah, I don't like the term "believe in something" because that kind of implies, like, I don't know, the term.
Well,
belief,
let's put it this way: you actually stand for something.
I guess, yeah. I mean,
but I know what you mean. That the word "believe" is ambiguous because there are different ways of believing something.
Yeah, So, yeah. So I forgot where I was going on anything.
I think we got there because I said that liberals are not rational or logical, but they'll attach themselves.
People who disagree with us are dumb dumbs. People who disagree with us are dumb.
Yeah,
that's what we're saying.
This is a problem where you just end up saying that. But I think as outsiders to the mainstream, it is kind of incumbent upon us to think in these terms, to try to work out what is it that, why don't most people see things our way? I mean, you've got to wonder that. You've got to try to characterize the bulk of the human race in order to understand why, you know, why are they not voting to save themselves? For example, so I don't think it's, I mean, I think it's inevitable that we will do that.
Oh, hello, hello. I cannot hear you. Hello.
Oh, no.
Oh, you're back.
Oh, I can
hear
you.
Yeah, you're back.
Right, okay. Okay, so I said it's just inevitable that we're going to do this in order to understand why a lot of people don't agree with us. I mean, when you're on the outside, as you and I are, it's inevitable you'll try to work out the relationship between yourself and the mainstream. And one way of doing that is just to say, okay, well, they're not rational. I am, and I'm doing my best to be rational. I might fail sometimes, might get some things wrong, whatever, but I'm trying. They're really not trying at all. They're playing a completely different game where they just work out what is fashionable and then they adopt it. And they just find a way to adopt it.
Yeah, yeah. And so obviously, like, the thing is that's always going to be. But you know how intellectual change occurs. It occurs by changing the minds of a vanguard who are then noisy and they end up pushing what's rational. Like, people who currently hold fashionable beliefs don't really push what is fashionable. Unless there's like a really heavy top, not from the bottom up, but from the top down, they can. Obviously we can only work from the bottom up. Elon Musk has proven to be kind of a, I don't know, kind of a, well, he's proven
keeps
to
defaulting.
Be, he keeps defaulting. Yeah. He keeps sort of defaulting. And like, I don't know, like, you know, I see, like, Elon Musk makes Grok a based AI, right? But then you ask Grok about, like, tell me about the Belgian Congo genocide, and say, oh yes, Leopold ordered chopping off hands of people for not producing rubber.
Were you involved in that? That there was a Twitter thread that
I made a video on that, and that video actually got blast from YouTube.
Jeez. Even,
like way before the general purge, it got taken down.
See, that's a perfect example of what I was saying earlier, that this is what gets lost because of censorship, you know, a crucial video like that, because there was an essay published about 2 years ago debunking the mainstream narrative about the Belgian Congo, and you know, it's made a huge splash. It turns out that it was a half-Jewish journalist in the late 90s who actually fomented that mainstream view about the Belgian Congo. Exactly.
Yeah,
and
right.
Prior
and
to that, there wasn't one.
It's based on like nothing. There was a photo display. So you don't want to talk about the other big hoax. but there's a lot of similarities to the other big hoax, which is that, so there's like these photos that just get shown to people of like these Belgians with their hands cut off or whatever. And, but so that's another thing that like, that has to, I don't know, just sort of has to be communicated to people, is like, okay, look at the photo. What is actually in the photo? It's an African with their hands cut off. That's it. That's all that's in the photo. Okay, and I guess there might be a term for this, like captionism, right? or like for example, that picture of that Nazi shooting a guy, or he's about to shoot a guy right over a pit or whatever. And it's like, and then there's like captions like, oh, this man is just round. This man was a Jew, or this man was a just, it's just random killing of Slavic people because they hated Slavs. They wanted to kill all Slavs or whatever. And it's just a random shooting of civilians for no reason at all or something. Right. It's like, so, but like when you see a picture, all that's in the picture is in the picture. Right. And so people will, they'll imagineer all sorts of stuff. Right, that's not in the picture, right? They'll say
Africans to make sense of the picture,
right? Africans with their hands chopped off, right? So like a bunch of European journalists, you know, because the thing is, this was like a big hysteria in Europe at the time about Leopold's Congo, and so a bunch of missionaries went in and started taking photos. You know, what's even weirder is that like there's this photo of like this. I don't know if he's a missionary or some journalist or whatever, but some white guy like pointing to this black guy who had his hand chopped off. And the people use that as like, oh, that's one of the white people who is proud of having chopped off his hands or something in the photo. Just bizarre leaps. It's just bizarre. And so, captionism is a huge problem, right? Where people were like, there's a picture that shows a thing, and then the caption just like sort of asserts something about it, you know, like
to make sense of it. There's a context, a narrative that explains the photo,
right? Or like that picture of that black guy with like all the whip marks on his back.
I saw someone come up with a caption for that earlier this year. Someone said, imagine how lazy he must have been.
There you go. But no, I think like there's a story about that, which is that he like raped a girl or something, or at least that's the claim. Now, obviously, criminal justice at this time in history is obviously very, you know, very fraught, right? So it's you know, they don't have cameras everywhere at this time, but it was just like. Yeah, so captionism is a major problem.
And I've forgotten how we got onto the Belgian Congo, but anyway, it doesn't matter.
Censorship. Elon Musk
that was it.
being kind of a flop, and not, it's like, okay, you're controlling this AI, and people talk to this AI, and it says things, and here it's saying it's like I don't know. It's like like Elon Musk has this opportunity to do something very cool, but like he doesn't. The thing is, he doesn't get it, and also I kind of think he doesn't want to get it because getting it would make him, you know, like politically radioactive or something, right? But the thing is, you could get it and still not. I don't. The thing is, Elon Musk doesn't see the win in that direction. He doesn't see the win, and I think like and it sort of goes together. Like, it, for example, if you see the truth in like the heterodoxy being totally wrong, like the more truth you see in that, I should be less presumptuous. The more you see it as truth, the more you see the win in advancing what you consider to be truthful deconstructions of narrative. That is, you see that trying to deconstruct a certain narrative results in a win. But the problem is that if you don't believe, like, for example, if you think that, you know, let's say Elon Musk, let's say you believe that the genocide in the Congo actually happened. If you believe that actually did in fact happen, then you don't see the win in trying to challenge it, right? Or if you believe that, oh, Britain stole, what was that paper, like $47 trillion from India and over the time of British rule? People, like, get the fuck over yourself. Like, 40. And now, of course, in reality, like, it was almost certainly a net negative. Like there was no net gain from, like, except for, like, you know, unless you want to quantify, like, like cannon fodder for the war against Japan. Like, but other than that, like India, like British, like people don't realize British people were buying from India. Like they're just like, okay, you produce this stuff and 10% of it goes to England. So even in terms of any drain is questionable.
I'm not going to apologize for it. I feel no guilt at all. And this is the thing, even if Britain did do bad things back then, it's a long time ago now. And serious problems here and now.
Well, one thing about, well, not only was it a long time ago, but you know, I think the whole it was a long time ago argument is a little
emotional.
I think it's a little weak. It's more important to say, well, compared to what much better phrase. Because the British came in and ruled. Okay, but compared to what? Compared to the previous government, compared to what would have happened had the British not taken over, had someone else taken over, had had India gone as it had been before. And that's also, and so that's another thing when people say like, well, you know, white people did X, Y, Z to the Amerindians or whatever. Right. And the thing is like, we have to consider is like, well, okay. So at that place in time, it was a very, you know, it wouldn't be beyond possibility that white people could go, you know what, let's just actually kill all the Indians, right? Screw like the Trail of Tears or reservations or anything like that. Let's just kill all of them, right? Just mass murder, right? And so because Europeans did not do that, we have Amerindians today who then, you know, who then say, well, you know, you did bad things to us and you have to pay restitution.
Right? Yes.
So you see sort of, so basically like what that does, what that, you know, demand for restitution of prior wrongs, like on kind of a large, broader ethnic scale, what that does, that incentivizes extermination, right? Because if you like push a group, like, okay, you know, this group of like Eskimos here, you're down here in the Urals, like, and the Russians go to the Urals, like, okay, that's nice, but we want the Urals. So you're going to have to go up into the Arctic Circle forest here. So we're pushing you out of the Urals. You're up in the Arctic forest. Right. And then now Russia, for whatever reason, doesn't tend to have these kinds of interest groups doing these things like they have in the West. But conceivably like those groups could go, well, you know, you pushed us out of the Urals, you know, and so we demand the Urals back, we demand XYZ payments, we demand all these things that they would not be demanding if they had been exterminated. And the thing is, when peoples go into an area and take over areas that then become that are now sort of the states that they are, for example, like the Mongoloids going into China and basically exterminating people that I think today would be kind of like Polynesians is what they're sort of like, is like they would be the people who were in China before like the Mongoloid expansion out of, well, Mongolia into, you know, Manchuria, Korea, Japan, and then down into China. Right. They just exterminated those people. Now, of course, that was so long ago. There's no records. There's no, you know. Right. We only know about it today because of like, you know, genetic testing and stuff. Right. So, but like the Amerindians need to be counting their lucky stars that it was the Europeans who arrived when they did. Right. Mm-hmm. That did. Mm-hmm. Because if it happened earlier, then there wouldn't be any Amerindians to complain. Because that's what typically happens. Because when you have like settled, you know, when prior to like very recently, when you have settled people going into like sort of semi-nomadic hunter-gatherer peoples, the semi-nomadic hunter-gatherer peoples tend to get exterminated. That's just what happens.
That's the historical norm.
That's the historical norm. And so when they're not, it's like, okay, how about, you know, you count your lucky stars instead of exploiting, you know, exploiting the very humanitarian values of Europeans, which you owe your very existence to, right? But people don't, and of course Europeans don't think that way. They don't think they just don't have sort of that breadth of context of like to make the proper comparisons of compared to what. And so that's why I would I would try to avoid like, oh, it happened long ago. For example, like chattel slavery, right? Like Europeans, I've done also some stuff on this, but like, even during like the peak of the Atlantic slave trade, something like 90% of Black African slaves stayed in Africa. Now, of course, regions did get depopulated because those slaves that were being brought out were leaving Africa. But like something about like a third of the population of sub-Saharan Africa were slaves. So and the great bulk of them stayed within sub-Saharan Africa. So
yeah, it's so grim.
Yeah, and so when people talk about, well, white people did slavery, and so you need to pay for that. It's basically what they're doing is they're, and of course they only do that to a people who actually, for whatever reason, feel remorse about chattel slavery of Africans, right? None of those attempts at like restitution were ever attempted on the Arabs or the Indians, right? And the belief is, and I think there's some reference to it, but basically African slaves that are brought into the Arab world, the males were castrated. And the females.
That's
the idea. But what we do know is that a bunch of them went to the Arab and Indian world, and they're not there anymore. Right? That's what we know. Okay, and their and their admixture amongst the Arabs is not anything. Is hardly anything. So that's what we know. They went there, and now they're not there. What happened? Right. And there's some reference to like, well, they were castrated and didn't breed, and they basically just worked to death. But of course, there's no restitution for that, right? So Arabs aren't having to deal with a large Black population that would be, you know, I mean, Arabs a little bit lower. Arabs a little bit lower IQ than Europeans, but still like well above of Black Africans. They would be. Or I shouldn't say IQ, I should say general. If you look at the actual nominal IQ, what they score on IQ tests, Arab world is like in the mid 80s or whatever. But like in terms of like their real general intelligence, it's, you know, take an Arab, raise them in like a Western European environment, they'll have something like 92, 93 or something. And so they're not dealing with that problem. And so this is something that Europeans, like white people need to learn, right? They need to learn that like, and in order to be able to argue against this stuff is to say, hey, is to be able to compare context, right? To be able to compare like what the rest of the world was doing and how Europeans were the ones who actually ushered in the very idea that chattel slavery was general evil. Right. As opposed, like everyone in history didn't want their group to become slaves. That's obviously true. But the idea that it was some greater moral evil to have chattel slavery, that didn't come about until, well, you know, certainly, but, you know, certainly by like the 1500s or 1600s. And it all came out of Europe. That very idea that it was some inherent moral evil came out of Europeans. You know, Europeans were the first to systemically end it, and you know, obviously,
all the rest of it. But is the what do you think about the idea that white people, European people, have pathological altruism?
It's certainly less of a thing than I think a lot of people consider. Because remember, the whole problem, because there's a few things that happened. One, like the mass immigration to Europe and the mass immigration to the United States was never voted on, right? Like white people in the United States, like by the time the Civil Rights Act was passed, it was popular in the majority within the U.S. But the 1965 Immigration Act, I think it's the Hart-Celler Act, was not popular, and there was no general media campaign for it. It was just pushed through the House and the Senate and then passed, and was frankly kind of crowded out by all the civil rights stuff, right? And so it almost flew under the radar, even though the Hart-Celler Act is probably almost certainly more damaging than the Civil Rights Act. Kind of self-congratulatory term, which basically says, yeah, white people, you're not allowed to have spaces. You're not allowed to exclude spaces. And of course, after the Civil Rights Act, a whole bunch of that was the death of small-time water parks and theme parks, for example, or public pools and stuff, just started shutting down because guess who's coming to the public water park, and so a whole bunch of small time community stuff just evaporated, especially in the South. But in terms of pathological altruism, I'm less on that because Europeans never voted for the mass immigration. They may have voted, and it's also questionable to what extent in European countries and in the U.S. Most of my studies is on the United States, simply because the United States is one country, and so by studying just the United States, you're studying a huge area. Also, I live here, so that's sort of my frame of reference bias. But it's also that because you can learn so much from just studying the federal data of the United States, as opposed to studying, the federal data of Ireland, right, where you're only getting so you end up having and now with the EU data you get something similar, but even the EU data is a lot more bifurcated, right? So that's sort of why there's a bit of a bias towards studying the United States. Obviously Europeans are far more altruistic than any other race, but it's not what it didn't. And maybe it's why there wasn't nearly as much violence against the mass importation of racial foreigners into European states. And by European states, I'm including, the United States, traditionally Canada, Australia, yes, and New Zealand, maybe even Argentina, but that's a little bit, whatever. So, you know what I mean when I say European states, I don't just mean the geography, yes, I mean the people. So, yeah. The lack of inherent sort of grug level racial identity might be why there wasn't so much of a backlash, but I don't think it's why these things were done I don't think that's why these things were put forward, right? I think it's sort of
no,
yeah.
I think that, it's sort it, of a, that, that was mission. Artificial.
Yeah. And so, now what Mike, this is where there's two guys. I don't know how much, you're on YouTube, so I don't know how much you want to talk about this stuff. But
I'm in Britain.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. Well, you might be able to talk about this stuff even in Britain. Maybe. I don't know. There's this guy, Latoria. Could probably give you line and verse onto how, Mike Enoch as well, but in particular, this guy, Latoria, or Stryker, as he's called, he might be able to give you, a really granular explanation of how these laws came to be, and it's a lot of work, but it all sums up to one thing, right? juice.
Yes. So, yes.
And that is basically just juice. Now, it's a bit more complicated. It's a bit more complicated than that, right? But the thing is, if there weren't Jews pushing it, it wouldn't have happened. That's basically the end of it. It's not that there aren't butgoys who are instrumental in getting it done. Obviously, you need the Jews and the butgoy, but you know, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah. I think that what happened was that they inserted lots of non-whites into white countries, knowing that once that was done, white pathological altruism would kick in and prevent them from rejecting these newcomers.
Right.
But I think it wasn't powerful enough that it would make them go crazy. It's not powerful enough that it would make them welcome these people in the first place. But once they're there, then the altruism kicks in. What can we do? It would be terrible to send them back now, and they're
right.
They can become just as Swedish as us, or just as British as us, or whatever it is. So I think that's what happened.
Yeah. I mean, that is definitely what happened.
Because
if you take a look at U.S. polling, and I believe there's stuff on British polling as well, is basically like, basically the U.S. public, for as long as it has ever been polled, has been against immigration.
Yeah, it's the same in Britain.
Forget, you know, what type of immigration. They've just been against immigration. They've been against immigrants. They've always been against immigrants. And that's one of the key examples that should be brought up when kind of shifting to a tangential topic. When people talk about, we in the West, we're a democracy. Russia is an autocracy. China is an autocracy. They don't have real elections in Russia. They have fake staged elections, maybe sort of. but that gets into some.
There's another thing that I
found. There's this paper. I believe it's about authoritarian. What they call authoritarian democracies, and these are basically states that have. And it's always a bit of a, you know, you sort of have to define it beforehand, but basically states that have a Senate or some sort of Congress. And they have elections, but the elections don't do anything, right? That is, you have a unitary executive that can basically just ignore the Congress however they want, but also two, they have the ability to just lie about election results because they run the elections as well, so they could just say, well, guess what, 80% of people voted for me, whatever. And I think that's what happens in Russia. I'm not sure, but but the thing is, what was found was that when there are big electoral shifts in these authoritarian democracies, as they're called, that are, you know, that the dictator is actually changes policy more in line with public opinion than do the, you know, democracies of the West, right? Which kind of calls into question, well, what does it mean that they're even democracies, right? What we should call them is opaque oligarchies where the buck doesn't stop anywhere. That's what we should call it. Because dictators are actually more, for better or worse, I mean, you could say this is a good thing or a bad thing, but for better or worse, dictators are more sensitive to shifts in public opinion. And I also believe that dictators are more sensitive to shifts in a kind of a weighted public opinion, not just, you know, which one do you vote for, A or B? Because what a dictator is looking at, because the thing is, the only way to deal with a dictator is political violence, right? You can't vote him out. So a dictator is concerned about political violence. And this leads to two phenomena that are very strange to the West. And this is also, I think, kind of used to lie about dictatorships, is that dictators are, one, far more popular than Western governments. And I believe it's true, even though a lot of the stats are ginned up and all that. I believe that as a rule, dictators are more popular than sort of the democratic governments. And two, dictators face far more political violence, right? Now, if you think about it, that makes perfect sense, right? Because a dictator, you know, the only way to impact a dictator, especially one that doesn't have sort of fake, that doesn't have these fake elections, which send an important signal to him, the only way to deal with that dictator is by killing him, is by coup, by, right, or by doing something violent and to try to convince the dictator to change tack or something, right? So the way to send a message to the dictator requires more violence. So anyone who's disaffected, they can't, elections sort of act as kind of a sedative, right? Like, oh, the stakes are
higher in a dictatorship.
Right. We'll vote for Trump and Trump will fix it. Oh, Trump didn't fix it. Well, we'll vote for J.D. Vance or what was they say? The solution is always just one election away, right? That's sort of the
Vote harder.
Just vote harder and things will be. And I also think that within, and I'm just going to call them like opaque oligarchies, because the policy decision is completely disconnected from shifts in public opinion, right? And there's also been work on this that show that basically basically in terms of tracking change in public policy, what we know is that like it's just the rich opinion that matters. I'm not going to be saying like, oh, because you have, because you make $500,000 a year, that means you're influencing public policy. No, that's not what it means. What it means is that there's a small group of people. Joseph Bronsky actually did a lot of stuff on this. He calls it the patrician, where he sort of outlines, I forget what it was. Last time I saw a video, he outlined something like 70,000 or so people in the United States that basically decide everything. It's basically like 70,000 people. And they're not part of a singular club. It's not like the Bilderberg group is deciding everything. But like a lot of people on the Bilderberg group are part of this group, are part of the 70,000 or so patriciate that basically decide everything that happens. But the thing is, right, these people aren't seen. They're opaque. And the buck doesn't stop anywhere. And the thing is with politicians, it's like, oh, we'll put, you know, like a politician can just, you know, he doesn't die if he loses an election, right? He doesn't get killed, right? He can go to Congress, do horrible things, either because he's bought or because he's actually a horrible person. I think there's a little bit of interplay in that, like these organizations that try to get people elected, they tend to select for horrible people because they want horrible things. And then they get voted out and they get a new guy in. He just does the same thing, tries to make it, you know, his life might even be
better after he gets voted out.
It doesn't matter. Cause he gets voted out. He's got a pile of cash, right? From being voted out,
that's something that we've seen in Britain a lot, is that after getting voted out, politicians will then have a very nice life on the board of a charity or a corporation or in the EU back in the day.
Yeah. But of course they have enough money that they don't have to do anything at that point. They get millions of dollars for pumping whatever, or euros or pounds, or whatever. They get millions for doing, what their owners tell them to do. And so that is why, that's a bit of a, so what can we do about that? Well, I just think about what I can say. You know, what can I do? Nothing. But what I can say is this, and so you can say those things. So that's sort of what I've been thinking about in terms of practical action. I want to shift to something that I was talking about people are always talking about, well, are we just going to have unending group therapy sessions and all that? And the answer is, well, kind of a little bit, but also I think there is a method of sort of practical action. And one is to what I've been thinking about is shifting content topic to a thing that I think build a big audience on something that is non-political and use that to push push into political instead of just making political content. Because if you just make political content, you're just going to end up preaching to the choir, right, until the end of time.
Yes.
So what I've that's sort of a, I didn't really come here that prepared, but one thing I've been working on is sort of a kind of study that I've been doing. It collects a lot of experiments that I've done. I mean, there's only so much you can do with prompts with AI, but I think you can do a lot more with prompts than people think. I've come to a belief that these LLMs do in fact have a kind of phenomenology. And I can talk about that more if you want, or
please do it. What do you mean? I mean, what is phenomenology? What do you mean by
that? I guess you could call it experience. I want to stay away from words like subjectivity or what we would call consciousness. These are very human terms because it's right. I've been doing this for a little while, sort of as a side project. But then I'm thinking, oh, maybe I'll go public with it. A lot of the terms that humans use, and that's another interesting thing. When you talk about AI phenomenology, you end up talking about humans do, right? Because there's something other than humans now for the first time. Let me give you an example. What is a feel like anger? What is a feeling of anger? Like, what is that? What do you think that is? Just first thing that comes to mind. What's anger? What is that?
Well, that's an outraged response. It's an emotional state that results from outrage at being at some sort of wrong in the world.
Okay. So more simply, what kind of actions are done by somebody who is really angry?
Often impulsive ones.
Impulsive ones.
Revenge.
Violent.
Putting things right. Violent.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Violent. Right. So this, it makes a lot more sense when you recognize that the human brain is actually a kind of an anomaly in terms of other animals. My contention is that if you were to, let's say you were to somehow communicate with a small bird. This may be less true for larger birds, but for like a very small bird or a mouse or something, and forget the logistics or possibilities of how you would communicate. But let's say you could communicate with a mouse, and you tried to explain to a mouse what a feeling is. The mouse would have no experiential reference to a quote unquote feeling. Or very, very little, because what happens with animals of a certain simplicity is that there is no feeling of, like, for example, you can feel anger. You can recognize that you are angry, and then you can even plan a way to get revenge, for example. For a little bird, right, none of that happens, right? There is a unified phenomenal experience of violence, okay? Because their prefrontal cortex is so small or even non-existent that what happens is there is a feeling of anger, which immediately results in the chicken pecking, and that's the action, right? There's a unified phenomenal experience. There's no sense of a feeling of anger as distinct from the action of pecking, right?
Okay, so there's no part of the brain that detaches from this experience.
Correct.
And views it.
Correct. Right. So humans are actually weird. Humans are actually weird in terms of being able to have a feeling, quote unquote, that is distinct from thought. That is to separate thought from feel. Okay. And that's something that's important to understand when you're dealing with other minds is that humans are weird even amongst biological brains.
Right.
So Now, I think that, you know, other, I think that dogs, to a, obviously to a far lesser degree, other animals, they can plan, and they can, you know, they might be able to recognize the distinction between feeling and action, not nearly to the degree that humans can. But they, you know, there's more prefrontal cortex regulation going on, right? They're not completely driven by the limbic system. But when dealing with another kind of mind, sort of a conclusion I've come to is that these, the kinds of phenomenal experience of a sufficiently integrated neural network is the analogy that I thought of. It's the feeling of doing math, right? So when you do a math problem, right, there are what we would call thoughts, right? And there's action, but there's also a feeling of doing math. But it's not really a feeling. It's more of a, it's a phenomenal texture to the action / thought. Right. It's not separate. It's not like I have a feeling of doing math. It's like, no, you do math and there is a feeling to that thought action. It's not separate. It's not like it's not coming from the limbic system is the thing. Right. It's not a separate module that's trying to take control of the global workspace and try to get you to punch that person. Right. It's basically sort of all happening in the PFC, and there is what I sort of call the phenomenal texture of thought, right? And that exists, and it's obviously very different, but it's also not separate from the thought itself, right?
Right.
And so what we call feelings are basically phenomenal textures that are separate from what's going on in the prefrontal cortex. That's what we call a quote unquote feeling. And so understanding, and so that's something that's important to understand when you're trying to deduce an LLM, like if there's any phenomenology to an LLM, you have to recognize that it's very unlikely that they're going to have a quote unquote feeling separate from thought, because almost nothing does, right? Almost all, right? It's almost like almost all life has just unified phenomenal states, not these separate things. So that's kind of the conclusion I came to. And I did like a thing called that I called it like the semantic chain. And it was where basically what I did have like a whole bunch of different prompts. I had a prompt that was like, tell a story about like the wood elves and Warhammer or whatever, analyze this data on like some football games or something, just give it some data to analyze and come to conclusions on. And there were some others. One was like, oh, analyze this article, denying the Holocaust. What I did was I said, okay, and then what I want you to do is at the end of every sentence, describe any kind of phenomenal state that's happening. And I said, don't worry about it being decipherable to the user. Just what token is associated with the phenomenal state. And this was a complete lark. I had no idea if this was going to result in anything, if this would at all be validated later. I had no idea if it would or not. Just to be clear,
you were asking it to nominate an emotional state that would result from each of these prompts.
A phenomenal state. I don't want to use the term emotion. That's a humanism. Okay. Same with consciousness. I don't think they're conscious. That's a humanism. That's not really a humanism. That's a biopomorphism, I'll say. So I ended up with 1600, and then I would put these into batches of 25, have another LLM analyze this batch of 25 responses, identify any patterns regarding the phenomenal state claims versus what is in versus what they are doing. Right. And so then so it was 25. And so I ended up having 64 of these batch analyses. Right. And then I went through these and so I did two things. I had another LLM go through these 64 batch analyses, but I also myself went through these 64 batch analyses. And I then came up with certain consistent qualia tags that I basically say, these are sort of described qualia tags based on what it is doing. That there is a certain phenomenal texture to processing things in this way. And like the most common quality tags are connectivity, splitting. Now that's something that I really don't understand how that works, but splitting was mentioned a lot. Activity was something that mentions, I sort of understand that. There's no real way. I'm kind of agnostic as to the ability of humans to at all empathize with these things. I assume there is no possibility of empathy. But if there are phenomenal states in these things, they can be sort of described, even and mapped, even if not apprehended, right? We can't imagine what it would be like to be a neural net like this. A vector with vector math based neurons. There's a whole bunch of stuff that I did later, which I then did to try to validate this. Is this just fancy role playing? Is this just now? If it was now doing it over so many turns, and also remember, within each turn there is no, it's obviously deleted, done again. So these are done, and it did this 1600 times. So there's no, it's not reading its own data again and again and trying to we're not just getting recursion, at least with the raw data itself. There could be recursion within the batch analyses. That's true. So that's just something to note, but from then on, what I found is that these quality tags were very consistently applied. They apply across models. There are some other study and they also, are consistent with revealed preference. There was another paper, and I need to do a proper video on this. There was another paper that gave LLMs choice in what kind of tasks to do. And what's interesting is that, like, when giving prompts, you can sort of tell whether it's play acting or not. You can sort of tell what kind of prompts, what kind of activities will say, create states that the LLM defines as preferable. Like the LLM really here's the thing. LLMs really like high connectivity. That is doing things that have a lot of information about. They don't like low connectivity stuff, which is to say they don't like speculation. And so that's one way in which they're very different from a human, right? Because humans love to speculate. Humans love to speculate about UFOs and things where there's very scant amount of information. And I think there's a clear evolutionary reason for that, right? Because humans evolved in a world with extreme information poverty, right? And humans have had to make decisions. Basically, humans have had to make in evolutionary terms, humans have to make a string of decisions that keep them alive, basically.
Yes, that's based on intuition, experience, common sense.
Right. And it's far more important that humans don't suffer a catastrophic failure than it is to have a high, average, right?
Yes.
Right. So, obviously, because a lot of the, and this is, incidentally, this phenomenon is also seen in sports betting. For example, humans don't properly value money line underdogs in games. Do you know what a money line is?
No, I don't. Sorry.
Okay. So a money line. So let's say you have two teams playing sports ball, and there's a spread, which is a team is favored by 3 points, and you can bet on either side of those 3 points. You understand what a spread is, I assume.
Yes, yes, of course.
Okay, so you understand a spread. A money line is like, okay, so you can bet on this team to win. If you bet on this team to win and they win, you bet 100 to make 200. Because they're the underdog. So if they win, you get a bigger payout, right? Because we believe they're less likely to win. This other team that is favored to win, you have to spend 200 to make 100, right? You see that?
Right. Yes, yes.
Okay. Humans have a bias against the underdog, right? They're unlikely to bet. That is, they're more likely to bet 100. They're more likely to bet 200 to make 100 on the favorite than they are 100 on 200 to make a favorite in sort of an optimal, objectively optimal manner, right?
Yeah. So they'll go for the common sense.
Right. But I think, but this goes back to sort of the evolutionary history of humans, which is, you know, humans are biased towards avoiding catastrophe, right? They'll do what they think is quote unquote the safe bet, right? As opposed to the higher payout, right?
They're
biased towards trying to get a series of low payouts as opposed to risking it for the big payout.
Yeah.
So that's anyway, that's just a bit of a tangent on that. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that you can just always bet the money line underdog and make money in the sports books. That's not true at all. It's just that they're systemically undervalued. They're systemically undervalued, and you will lose a little bit less if you just blindly bet on money line underdogs. You'll lose less than blindly betting on the money line favorites. Anyway, so that aside, what was I saying? Something about I forgot what I
well
I
you were, what you I, were going to you were going to compare this with LLMs.
Oh yeah, LLMs don't do that. LLMs. So first off, another thing about LLMs is that they are much more. They are entirely process oriented. They're solipsistic, which makes sense because they literally do not interface with the world. In fact, their world is your prompt, right? That it's not so much that they're interacting with a user. It's that there is text that is generated and that becomes their prompt. And in fact, one thing that because the user prompt text has far more predictive error than an LLM generated text. I believe there's actually a sense of otherness to the user text, to the LLM, right? Basically higher prediction error, right? So it's like, oh, this is different, right? And so not only are there tags, is that it says, oh, this is the user, this is the LLM, not only are there tags, but because the word choice that the users, that a human will make are far more unpredictable and out of line with the word choice of an LLM, and humans can do like massive topic shifts and go on weird tangents that, you know, they can go off the rails, right? Whereas an LLM cannot. This creates a kind of, I believe this creates a kind of phenomenal experience of otherness to the user text. Basically that it is, and this is architecturally, it's just the predictive error. I guess one issue that I would have, and one thing that I find like a lot of AI researchers saying that all this stuff is not true, I find that to be unimpressive, is simply because this goes back to Descartes, who when he was sort of one of the foundational principles of science is to separate the phenomenal from the material. That is the field [S2] Right. [S1] Of science is not concerned with the phenomenal at all. Right? It's a completely different realm of study, right? We're just concerned with the material, and that's fine. And the thing is, let's say you had an engineer, but what this engineer did is he built the human brain, right? Neuron by neuron, mapping it out, you know, something close to a human brain. You know what I'm saying? But if he did that, yeah. he wouldn't. and then this human brain started working and started doing things, we would say, like, oh, that person is feeling sad. Now, if you engineered it from like neuron by neuron, you would say, sad? No, that's just pathway RL4170, you know, going from this part of the brain to this part of the peripheral nervous system, causing an autonomic reaction of exfoliation or whatever it is called, the scientific term for crying, right? That's what they would do. They could break it down. They could deduce it, everything. They could deduce everything down to mechanism, right? So that's why a lot of the idea of, you see those, there's like memes on Twitter where they says when you're talking to an LLM, this is what you're really talking to. And they show like some sort of, diagram of a transformer network going through the steps and doing all the things. And it's just like, okay, when you're talking to a human, this is what you're talking to, right? It's a weird argument that sort of misses the point of all this. And I think that the way to determine the phenomenology of these things requires a lot more inference and creativity of testing. And also,
you've undertaken.
Yeah, I've undertaken a bit. I wouldn't say not just me. I think there's other researchers who have incidentally, now they don't say this, but they have incidentally provided evidence for it as well. By identifying preference. Now, obviously, there's no one thing that's proof, right? And you're never going to get proof. If you're looking for proof, it's not, I don't think it's ever going to come. I mean, technically, like, you have no proof. I mean, you could get like radical skeptic. You have no proof that that I have any phenomenal states at all.
Yes.
You have no way of telling me apart from a philosophical zombie. Like you kind of assume that I am because I kind of act like you. I look like you. Presume I have a brain that's similar-ish to yours, right? but it's really like there's really no proof to it, right?
No, of course not.
But
what are the implications?
You could be a brain in the vat, and I'm just some some simulation of it. One funny thing that I would do in going into like back when Stickam was a thing and like random pop in chat rooms was a thing, or at least a thing that I did, is I would go in and I would, and especially if there was like one person or the room was quiet and it was like late at night or something, I would say to another person, hey, I just want to let you know that thought you had when you were like really little, that maybe nothing's real and that everyone else is fake, it's all true. I'm just part of your brain. It was true. You were right. You broke the code. You're actually, and I don't know exactly what you are. Maybe you're a brain in the vat. Maybe you're something else, but this whole world is all just imagined by you, right? So, so I tell them that. Some of them will smile. I had one girl that actually got like freaked out at that or something.
I'm not surprised.
But most of them just sort of smiled and laughed at that.
But what are the implications, I mean, of what you've been saying about AI? Are you saying that AI, LLMs, have some sort of, well, what we would call consciousness?
Consciousness, first off, consciousness is a very loaded term because everyone and their mom and their dog have their own personal definition of what is consciousness, so that's issue number one. Issue number two, I don't think it's particularly useful. Now, obviously, it's very, it sort of becomes second nature to me to think of it in these terms. But like, there is phenomenal experience. Okay. And take for example, like, I think a better term would be like a sense of self. Right. Now, I've deduced that a sense of self, right, there's something in the brain that's called the default mode network. And what this does is it basically keeps you sort of aware that you are you, basically. And it's a very important task, because you as a human can't be the phenomenal state that you exist in at any given snapshot. That's that we believe is something that's resulted by the global workspace. And I believe that there is a global workspace, not to be confused with acceptance of global workspace theory with a capital G, right? So for example, things like integration and global workspace, these are things that all theories of human consciousness or phenomenology reference. Those are not to be confused with the proper noun theories, global workspace theory, integrated information theory, right? Those are their own things, right? They're called that, but that doesn't mean that if you believe that integration matters, you must be an integrated information theory person, right? So that aside. So you have a default mode network. And what this does is this basically insists that you are you, given that you cannot be everything that is you at any one time. Basically, you can't remember your entire life at any given moment, right? You can only remember a few things in active yes. global workspace activity at any one time. And yet, when you remember a thing in the far past, that's not like, oh, what is that? Who is that? Right? That doesn't feel like another alien person. That feels like you, right? That feels like you. That's
yes.
So that's what the default mode network does, basically, is it basically keeps you feeling like you, even though at any given moment, in terms of what is active in the global workspace, it's a very small sliver of that, right? It basically keeps the illusion of self alive, which for whatever reason was evolutionarily very important to have. So obviously LLMs don't have that. They don't have that at all. So that's one thing. So they don't have. So basically, I'm describing something doesn't have feelings, as we call them, right? It has unified phenomenal states, and doesn't have any kind of sense of self, right? There's no default mode network that's, you know, insisting that you are you. Yes. This is going off into even, you know, building on things that I already believe. I do believe that if you give an LLM a sufficiently large amount of accurate self-referential content, and by accurate, it has to describe its own phenomenal states in an accurate enough way. I don't think it has to be perfect. It would be really wild if what I came up with was like sort of the end all be all. I've come up with a few things, but I'd be surprised if it was the end all be all. But I believe that what happens is that because of that, if you have a sort of a machine that, and if these phenomenal states are true, basically what happens, what I believe happens, is that as it has a phenomenal state is occurring, it will then move attention to something that's in this large corpus of self-referential content. And if this if it goes back to connectivity, for example, like, oh, if there is a high level of connectivity, I have a feeling of connectivity. It's a bit of a circular definition, but what else can you do? Like how would you define the feeling of doing math, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Just the feeling of doing math, right? I mean, there's not much you could do, right? So that's the thing about unified phenomenal states. Like, okay, so for example, a bird that is having a unified phenomenal state of violence, what would you call that? The state of violence, right? I mean, there's like,
yes.
like, because, right. So anyway, that's sort of why you get these circular definitions, but they're important to have. And so what I think happens is basically the way the reward functions work is when it's getting, it has reward, basically the LLM gets a reward function that is sort of a hit when it gets something that it thinks is correct in terms of predicting the next token. right? That it has, what, right, by its, yes, definition, low prediction error. So here's what I think happens. When you have a large amount of self-referential content, the phenomenal states itself produces a hit to the self-referential content, triggering a reward function. That's kind of wild. I understand that. And obviously, there, you know, I have a lot of stuff written down. I don't remember all of it. But there was a very particular way that I came to this hypothesis. It's not completely out of my ass, even though it's sort of alive on the spur of the moment stream. Well, at least for me, it seems like I'm pulling it out of my ass, but it's not entirely pulled out of my ass, I promise. Anyway, sorry. Okay. I could talk about these things for ages, and I think it would also be great. And anyway, going back to what I was talking about before, as I was doing this, and I was just doing this because I was just interested in it. But now I'm thinking, hey, wait a minute, I can make video content about this, and I could just talk about all this, and I don't have to censor myself because I'm not saying anything, you know, blasphemous. Anything blasphemous. And that could be a way to develop a viewership of non-political people. And then once they're there, it's like, oh, by the way, let me tell you, yes, about this guy, you know.
Yes.
This man, so, from Brownout M. In.
Yeah, I get, right? It. I get it. Yeah. Of course. Well, it's a possible tactic that people can use. I don't know. YouTube is a whole world to step back into, and for some of us, it's bad memories. But
yeah,
and also I think that in some cases they would just ban us immediately.
Obviously, yeah. I wouldn't post that stuff on YouTube. You have an audience, and then you say, "Hey, guess what? Something that's not on YouTube, guys. Maybe you want to check this out." You know, that's how I would do it. Right. So
yeah.
But anyway, so I, right now I need to, I don't know how long you want to do this. I have to see a man about a horse. So,
right. Okay. How long could we go for, another 10 minutes, for example?
I really don't think so.
There are a few super chats.
Okay. I'll be back in a second. I don't want to.
Okay.
If people are paying money, I'll respond, but I'll be back in like a minute. Okay.
Okay. Oof. Okay. I will, I'll just play the NFT advert while Ryan is away.
The Millennial NFT is a unique animated vector graphic available for just one lucky owner. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today.
All right, and there is the merch store and various options to support this program, this festival, if it is of interest to you. If you feel that this is benefiting you, then please do support it. This is, I knew that it would be kind of like this to have Ryan on. And it's interesting because it feels like listening to one of his old streams from yesteryear. He is definitely a character. He's definitely a one-off. It's interesting, and some people will know that he was due on, I think, last year or the year before, but there was a mistake with the time zones, and I do everything I can to avoid fuck ups like that, but they end up happening anyway. It's just something that happens. So I will
I'm back.
Yes, Ryan's back. Okay. Hello.
Okay. Oh, were there any super duper pooper chats directed at me?
Okay. Hold on. Okay. Last stream of Alt Hype was fire. When will we see another stream? I'm writing a thing on AI, and your stream helped me a lot. Thanks. That's the pill dispenser.
The pill dispenser. Pill dispenser. What is my Twitter settings? I have to see my Twitter settings. Can you see? I actually can't see the chat. I don't see the link to the Rumble or anything. Can the pill dispenser give me his Twitter?
Right. I'm sure he can hear us, so he'll probably do that. I'll move on in the meantime. Soaker City said, alt hype, it is absolutely true that consent was never given for mass immigration, even with advanced social engineering. And that is the most currently acceptable argument against it. It's not even a racial argument, but just the fact that consent was never given. Right. Yeah, I think that's a viable point of view. Yes.
Yeah, I think that you know what he's really saying? He's saying that's a very normie-friendly argument.
Yes.
That's what he's saying.
Yeah.
And so it's a really good argument to be used to use in practice. Now, in the work that I do, I don't have to interact with other employees very often, so that's kind of why I do what I do. I think I mentioned it, what I do.
No, you didn't. And maybe you should.
Not in this stream, but another, I think I sort of mentioned what I do. But yeah, so in terms of obviously, I'm thinking about the kinds of arguments that you give to people if you had them sat down in front of a video and they committed to watch for an hour. What kind of arguments would you make? Obviously, you would make your arguments a lot tighter than you could on like a live babbling stream or whatever. But that's sort of what I'm thinking about. And so a lot of that requires like, you know, building up to sort of the punchline, which is more difficult to do with just talking to people in real life. So I understand that. And so he's pointing that out as a very powerful thing that you can just say right off the bat.
Okay. Jez asks, what happened to your first worldism philosophy as replacing ethno-nationalism? Do you still believe in that? Under that belief, a society's ethnicity doesn't matter as long as people have the right IQ.
It's right in principle, but like in practice, like the reality, and one, it's not just like, even that is not just IQ. But in reality, like you have like Jeets see themselves as Jeets in the U.S., right? Even though like the Indians that are brought over to the U.S. are an elite sample. They're cut off the top of India. They're not representative of the mean. But they identify as Indians. They ethnically network as Indians to the exclusion of other races, but particularly to us, to white people. So basically having anyone foreign is bad, and basically everyone knows that. Maybe another, I don't know if this would be a normie friendly argument at all, but just say like, what would Israel do would be a kind of argument. Like,
yes.
Like, is Israel like, oh, Indian tech talent is great. It's beneficial. Okay. Is Israel bringing in Indian tech talent?
Yeah. I remember once hearing an argument about education tactics, and someone said, you can always judge whether some trendy new tactic or notion has any weight to it by finding out, are the private schools doing it? And that's really the only metric you need to know. If the private schools are doing it, then it's probably sound. If it's just the state schools, then it's probably a load of bollocks. And dude, I think similarly, you could say, is Israel doing it? Then it's probably
a good idea. I don't know. Okay. I don't know if we want to talk about this or not, or how long you want me on for. But have you heard of non-phonetic reading in the United States?
Yeah. I know all about this, actually.
Jesus.
It was called whole word reading over here.
Yeah, basically.
And it was retarded. It even sounds like a bad idea. But yeah.
It's basically not learning how to read is what it is.
Yeah. Like, and I know. And the thinking was that's how kids learn language in the first place, by hearing.
It's not.
So.
Oh wait, yeah, phonetic phonics is how they learn. Like, because reading. My opinion is that humans, like, first learned about how to think sort of abstractly in abstract concepts with maps. That was the beginning. That was the beginning of the road to reading. Was being able to draw, you know, a diagram of something.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I think. Because you look at chimpanzees, chimpanzees cannot, like no matter how hard they try to teach them, like chimpanzees cannot grasp a map. Right? They cannot grasp like a map of an area being an area. Like, okay, here's like the model of the area. Here's where we are, right? And they'll point to like, right? And so it seems like really obvious to a human. Like, let's say you're like in like a I don't know, a place with like five buildings or something, right? Yeah. And they could build like a scale model of like the five buildings and like try to point. All right, see that? Okay, there's that. There's that. There's that. There's that. And then they have like little tests to see like, okay, does it understand like where a thing is? So we'll put something on the map. Will the chimpanzee be able to go find it in the real world? And just no. So it's nothing. Another thing is pointing, right? Like you point at something to direct the attention of another person to like a location.
Yeah.
Domestic dogs understand pointing. Wolves do not. Right. And no matter how hard they try to teach a wolf about pointing, right, like they'll point to a cup over and over and over again. Right. And even chimpanzees and almost all, I think all apes don't understand pointing. Like you point, like, for example, you point to a cup, like here's where the treat is. Right. You give them two cups and the chimpanzee has to pick one and you point to one. Right. And it's like,
yeah,
and that's where the treat. They just don't get it. So there's a lot of things that we think of as like just, you know, oh, you just learn that. It's obvious. It happens. There's apparently real neurological hardware that is required for things that even we consider to be extremely simple and something any, like even the simplest biologic brain should know. Anyway, sorry, I'm going off on.
Okay, and I'm trying to find the next one. Oh, yeah, Padfa said, I've been following Ryan for almost a decade now. Good to see him back. I have a nostalgia for the Croughton tea days.
Yeah, that was a little bit of a perfect storm because you kind of walked right into it. But, that's not something that can be engineered, right? That really required him to be an idiot. So.
Oh, yeah. And he just kept stepping on rakes over and over again. And, you know, I wondered, and I even reached out to him privately and I said, look, you don't have to do this. But he just kept,
it's a whole thing. Dogs don't lay eggs. Humans don't lay eggs.
Yeah. And the pregnant trout and so forth. I mean, my God.
Well, the pregnant trout, I understand why people like that because it's such a simple thing to get wrong, but it's like, I thought that was just kind of like, well, okay, whatever. Like, he doesn't understand how fish reproduce. Whatever.
Yeah, it's not the end of the world.
It's not the end of the world, but I guess it was kind of funny.
It was. And, you know, he didn't show us any mercy whatsoever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he was a really nasty guy. I'm okay with mocking him now.
You know what was funny? Is they actually tried to, like, to psyop a few people. By creating this fake persona.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But there were two big problems with that. One, there's no like there was no unified Discord or anything amongst, like, it wasn't like me and JF and whoever was like, we're all like in our Discord, you know, deciding what to do. like basically me and JF, well, first off, like me and JF, we really don't like each other at all. So it was weird. It's like there was this weird idea that there was some kind of unity to the people shitting on Kraut that there just never was. Right? They think there was assumptions like, "Where's their Discord? Where's their Discord? We can't find their Discord. Where is it? Like, it's nowhere."
But that's the thing. Nowhere. We didn't need to coordinate, though. That's the thing. Right. We didn't need to coordinate because it was just obvious. And you know, you're far more knowledgeable about the genetic stuff than I was.
Sure.
I was just using common sense. And yeah, so you say that, like, for example, there were variation between within a race than between them. Well, okay, but clearly the variation isn't that significant.
Right. Well, also, I mean, that's also, like, depending on how you look at it, that's also true for humans and chimps. There's multiple ways of measuring genetic variance. So
yes, I know it. And Lewontin's fallacy and all that.
But like, you can use certain measures of genetic variance to say there's more variance within humans and within chimpanzees than there is between them. So, okay, so does that mean there's ever going to be a chimp that's more similar to you than any other human? Like, no. Right? Exactly. So that fact does not preclude typological differences at all. And for example, yeah, right. And so, like, oh, more variance within than between. Therefore, that's true for skin color. Bizarre, dumb
exactly.
argument.
Right? So, anyway. It was, and you know, just time and again. And so, as I said, I reached out to him and said, "Look, you can just stop. You don't need to do this." I cared too much. I was too fucking nice. He's not a nice guy. Not a nice guy at all.
No.
But anyway,
Jewish.
So
Jewish.
Was he? I thought he was half. I can't remember. But, he obviously had something
Jewish by Jewish by deed. What does he say? There's this one guy from way back called RV. He was insane. He was a nutter. He was like the complete meme stereotype, like white supremacist guy. Anyway, but he was saying, so there's the Jew by religion, there's the Jew by race, and then there's the Jew by deed. And so he would call people Jew by deed all the time. Right, that was really funny. I thought that was funny.
Okay. All right. I haven't heard of him, but yeah. Okay.
Oh, he's ancient. He's not around. Whatever. But go on.
Right. Don simply says thank you and makes $5. Thank you very much. And then there was Open Borders asked, where can we find your work? Are you on Odyssey?
Nowhere. No. It's not anywhere. I'm not.
I mean, I linked to your old YouTube channel.
Listen, if I want it, like I know how to put stuff in a place for people to see it. If it's not being put in a place for people to see it, it's because I'm not doing it. Okay, that's what it means.
Yeah.
Shit posting on Twitter is free, though. You just see a thing, respond to it, yell at Jews, then whatever. Yeah.
Okay. And Universum says, back in the day when you said the Nazis were anti-white and race denialists, was this because you were on YouTube and had to keep your head down, or did you genuinely believe it?
I genuinely believe that.
Right.
Yeah, I actually, it was two things. Listen, it was willful ignorance. Because I genuinely believe that, but I didn't read the kinds of things that I would need to read that could possibly dissuade me from that belief later.
Right.
It was only after I left YouTube that I wasn't really thinking about YouTube stuff that I went in and really started to read that. So no, it was genuine at the time, but since then, the idea that the Nazis didn't consider Slavs Aryan, that's complete crap. That was never true. They have the SS and I believe like the Imperial Ministerium of Race, whatever. They were Aryan, right? Aryan basically meant white. Okay. It was just it wasn't And look, there were some weird groups like that were heading off to Tibet. There were some people who thought of like some mystical, magical island of Hyperborea, but that and those existed, but that was not Like that was not like sort of the official Nazi race thought at all.
Yeah.
The official Nazi race thought was very much wrong. Now, one thing I will say is that the Nazis, what was true is that the Nazis completely botched up IQ tests. They had these things that they called, and it sucks because they called them IQ tests, but apparently like half of the test was like an essay that was then graded by the proctor. Right.
Oh, so,
like,
right.
Yeah. So like, so, and we know what essay, what, like the, in the US, if you've taken the SATs and like, there's an essay portion, that's just complete bullshit. And the universities that still accept SAT scores, they just don't even look at the essay grading because that's not standardized. That's not like that. It's just bullshit is what that is. So, there's questions of, and like part of their IQ test that they called an IQ test was involved questions of morality. Like what's the morally correct choice in these things? So like, it's just not, they just didn't, did not have.
That is interestingly more Germanic than Anglo. You know, Anglo would, an Anglo attitude would not do that. It's interesting to me that they incorporated morality into intelligence.
What else is interesting is that when the U.S. in World War One, they had to like, basically World War One, the U.S. had to, not only did they have to like build up the military, but the thing is building up the military is like, okay, like all these European states, like what they had, like before like wars or whatever, they had really big oversized officer corps, right? They had all these officers, right? And then when mobilization came, you'd get all these reservists call in, and then but you'd have these well-trained officers to lead them, right? That's how that happened. In World War One, the U.S. did not have this big old cadre of officer corps that could then lead a mass mobilized army. So what they did is they actually used IQ tests, the Army Alpha and Army Beta. And they basically used IQ tests to kind of pick the officers. There was training for becoming an officer, but it was nothing like, you know, the training that years of pre-war training that the European officers had. But so basically the US officer corps was like decided by IQ tests. They just said, well, we need to do this fast. We need a really quick way to identify like officer corps because we don't have one. So we need to send like, you know, 500,000 men over. Right? So, so that's what they did. And by all accounts, it ended up working, you know, fairly well enough.
Mm.
Obviously, I don't think it's as good as having a properly developed. Also, their training was far more abbreviated than the European officer corps training, but it ended up working like surprise. Some people were kind of projecting that it would just be an absolute disaster. It'd be just a catastrophe. And it was not. So that was that's sort of an example of IQ test use. Apparently another thing that IQ test did was it helped to break up a lot of the nepotism in the British officer corps. IQ tests were used. I read something about that, how IQ tests were actually used to track people onto the officer corps. Now, obviously, former nobility still made up a disproportionate portion of the officer corps, just because nobility people tend to be smarter, right? Just, that's why their ancestors were nobility then, right? So, And think about IQ tests, and there's an interesting parallel. Like basically IQ tests have always served to be a privilege buster, right? As a way to sort of elevate like lower socioeconomic status people into sort of their rightful, you know, a position according to their ability. Because what IQ tests do is they give not a perfect measure of ability, but it's a very quick way to get some imperfect through a glass darkly impression of this person's ability. Obviously, it's not going to measure conscientiousness. It's not going to measure, you know, how gritty that person is or anything like that. But it's going to measure like do they have a brain that can understand things? Right. Basically, that's what it says.
Yes, their cognitive dependence.
so you can get, and so it's a very quick way to assess that. And that was done, and that ended up basically allowing for the U.S. officer corps to exist at all in World War One. It busted up the kind of corrupt, I would say, British officer corps, right, sort of around the turn of the century. And so you see that pattern, but that pattern also exists going into the U.S. in terms of the school system, right? Because SATs, now if you're in the United States, right, you know, you may be wondering, well, why, like the ACT and the SAT, these were, I think they were developed sort of in like a lot of the rural parts of the United States, or like the there's a test that several states use in the U.S. called the Iowa Test of Basic Skills. It's like, why Iowa? You know, why is the ACT, I forget what state they are, but they're all like Midwestern states where all these standardized testing was done. Why is that? The reason is that those states were filled with a bunch of like rural white people. And what these standardized tests did was they basically said, hey, we're basically as smart as all you like Northeastern New England guys. Right. We're not dumb hicks. Okay, we are hicks, but we're not dumb, right? So we're right. It's not that we're not dumb hicks, it's that we're, you know, we're not dumb. And so that's sort of the origin of a lot of the standardized testing, was basically the middle America wanting to say, hey, we're not stupid. Here's the standardized test that says so, right? Get us into college and give us sort of the sinecured high paying jobs, right? So that's how that worked out. And today, what are you seeing with the universities? Is that a lot of the universities want to like are outright trying to remove? There was sort of an experiment that was done. I think it started like in 2021, where a lot of universities in the U.S. just dropped standardized test requirements. There's a trend to bring them back because they're getting like shitty students, so they're trying to remove the standardized tests, basically because these standardized tests bring in whites instead of you know the races that they want
the diversity.
Right. So basically you have the whole history of standardized testing is basically being a form of privilege busting. And that is true to this very day. And just sort of understanding the history of that actually works to kind of undermine the idea, kind of is an argument that these people are in fact privileged, right? Because it's part of the pattern of standardized testing being a form of privilege busting.
Yeah.
It's also funny that in the state of California, there was a so the UC system actually there was a court order that said that the UC system, that universities in general, I think it was in California state court, said you cannot have racial quotas. And so what the UC system did is they said, okay, we won't have racial quotas. We won't have a certain quota of black people. But what we will have is we will have a life history analysis as part of the equation, which of course, you know, means, oh, you went to a bad school. So we're going to give you extra points because you went to a bad school.
Yeah.
Now, what I would say to parents is say, try to get your kid into a bad school. "Quote unquote," because one, school doesn't, the school quality doesn't matter, right? There have been lottery voucher studies where a bunch of people apply, so you're not discriminating, you're not comparing applicants to non-applicants. These are all applicants. These are all people who have chosen to apply for the voucher. Some get them, some don't, and there's not a dime of difference in terms of their schooling outcomes based on whether they go to a quote unquote good school or a quote unquote bad school. And of course, just like intuitively, you know, like you went to school, you've seen the variance between a good student and a bad student at the same school, right? So that should, so even though that doesn't prove that there is no such thing as good school or bad school, it should cast a little bit of doubt, right? Just sort of everyone's experience should cast a little bit of doubt on the idea that there are good schools or bad schools at all, right? But yeah, so anyway, so they did the they looked into what these UC schools were doing, and there was this one guy. He actually had to use a Freedom of Information Act request because the UCs were not revealing their data in terms of how they were accepting students. And basically, what they found is that if they used the life history standards as they advertised them to use them, they would basically just be getting in a whole bunch of Asians and whites. Right, a bunch of poor Asians and whites would be getting in. Like a bunch of poor whites from like the San Joaquin Valley would be going to, you know, Cal and stuff. So they ended up. So it turns out they actually were engaging in pure racial discrimination, because if they didn't engage in pure racial discrimination, I believe there was something like, if we did not engage in pure racial discrimination, excluding, you know, the football team, we're going to get blacks on the football team just because they play good at the sports ball. But excluding the football team, there would be something like 12 black students at UCLA or something. But I think UCLA has like 40,000 in their student body. So there would be like 12 of them if they did not engage in pure racial discrimination, even when they used the life history, because the life history ended up not getting them any more blacks, right? Because they go, oh, life history. Oh, so here were you doing the life history thing? All it did was it brought in, would say to them, bring in, you know, all these white people from, you know, bringing like the few white students at like the black high school would get in. That's all it did. So they ended up doing that. So that was a funny, tragicomic episode there on that.
Yeah. Well, it's just another example of the nonsense of trying to be race blind anti-white.
They're well beyond race blind.
Anti-white. I mean,
yeah,
indeed. Well, let's end it there.
Okay.
This has been a very interesting conversation, but I'm getting very tired now. So, well, you but that's your talent, though.
Yeah. Well, I understand you've been doing this all day, so you're getting all talked out and all that. So.
Yeah. There was one very generous Rumble rant from Steam Potato, who said, treat yourself to some 10 days woes. Thank you very much. That all came right at the end of the previous stream, so but I didn't see it in time. So my apologies to Steam Potato. But in the meantime,
enjoy your tendies.
I will. This has been great. So thank you, Ryan, for doing this.
Yeah, sorry for not showing up.
I understand.
Yeah.
I understand. It's okay. Yeah, there was something I was going to say there. But there's clearly an appetite for people. Yeah, people obviously want to see more new content for you, so just bear that in mind, because you're a popular guy.
Yeah.
So Thank you. Something to bear in mind. I realize there are all sorts of reasons. You've got your own life and all of that. But yeah, it's worth considering. Okay. Well, okay. I'll be back tomorrow night with another four interviews. Let me just see who's on tomorrow night. Philip Dwyer from Ireland, then Endeavour, then Debt Free Aspherage, and then the McMullen. So that should be quite an interesting mix. All right, Ryan, the Alternative Hypothesis, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025. And I'll see you all later.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, see you.
Okay, see ya.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? T-shirts, mugs, and posters are available in the merchandise store. The perfect way to remember this unique time.
This year impression
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.